The following program contains heavy spoilers, deep insight, and absolutely no filters. Listener discretion is advised. Snobs on Film, my name is Arthur, your host, and I'm joined by my usual suspects, Isaac and Jahan. And we have a guest snob today. We are very happy to welcome Mr. Omar Dorsey to the show, best known for his role on Queen Sugar as Hollywood Desjardins. He's also been seen on episodes of Ray Donovan. Mm-hmm. He's been in The Blind Side. He's been in Django Unchained. He's been in Eastbound and Down, the HBO comedy with Danny McBride. And he has been in the latest Halloween, 2018 Halloween, co-written by Danny McBride, which is a movie that Isaac will never see, as we learned from our last episode.
Yeah, that's a scary movie. You don't want to go to that one.
Hey, we really want to thank you for taking some time out to hang with us.
No doubt.
We have, we have a really interesting topic today, something that we've been planning for a while, trying to get the right mix of question and debate set up. So for this episode, we want to talk about the singularity of Black actors in Hollywood, otherwise something we call the Denzel effect.
Yeah.
Right, which is that there can only be one Black megastar in Hollywood at a time. And we really want to know why and get
into
this.
In the world, right?
In the world.
And to center this question, we want to take a look at the rise of Hollywood's newest Black darling, Michael B. Jordan, and wonder why he's all alone. Before we kind of dig into it, I do want to say, though, for a time, I actually thought Chadwick Boseman was going to be the new darling. And the reason why is because in the last few years, he's done leads as Jackie Robinson in 42. He played James Brown in Get On Up, of course, T'Challa in Black Panther. Hey, you know, Omar, you and Chadwick missed working with each other on ER by a few seasons, didn't you?
Chad's one of my really good friends, man. You know, the whole thing about it is, like, we've all been doing this for 20 years. So you got Chad, got Mackie, Sterling K. We know we all came up together.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, we all thought it was going to be Mackie. Anthony Mackie was going to be the next one.
I see.
You know, he's Falcon.
Wow. So, I mean, obviously, this is kind of a known quantity, but just even amongst yourselves, it's like, who's next up to be slotted in that line?
Yeah, and who the industry is going to put a battery in, going to, make it explode.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, if you want to get into it, we can get into it. I don't know if that's the truth, right, at this point, about the two biggest movie stars in the world, you haven't even named them, and they're Black.
Is Kevin Hart one of them?
And The Rock. Those are the two biggest movie stars in the
world.
Okay,
but here's the thing. Does The Rock count?
Yeah, he says he's Black. He tells me he's Black.
He tells you that.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a Black man, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We did a movie together called Race to Witch Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a big fan of his anyway. I used to like wrestling when I was a kid. And so, you know, I'm like, I get to work with The Rock. So we were just chilling. He was like, you know, man, just, you know, being a Black man in this industry. Of course, he doesn't play Black people, you know? He doesn't.
Right.
It's not like he's playing Charlie Pride, or he's not playing, you know, people who are we're considering, like, you know, well, this is a Black man. He's any man, the same way that Vin Diesel is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also a Black man, and he'll tell you that too. But those are the two, to me, the two biggest stars in the world, The Rock and Kevin Hart.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know a lot of times we don't want to put the comedians, you know, in the same as actors. You know, like, well, it's only be one. When we talk about the one, we don't talk about Eddie Murphy and Denzel at the same time. When Eddie Murphy was the biggest star in the world.
Right.
So, and then we also talk about Chadwick. I mean, he has the biggest Black film of all time, by far. Not even close. And he was number one on the call sheet. But I know that they're putting a battery in Michael B's back. But then you also got somebody like Mahershala, who wins all the awards.
Mm-hmm.
who is one of the greatest. And, you know, I don't know if he's going to be the person to be box office like that, but he's got box office films coming out. You know, he has the movie coming out where I think it was Robert Rodriguez, the one that James Cameron produced. I think that we're living in a sort of a different time now than it was when it was just that it could only be one. And even when it could only be one, you know, we had a movie like Mo' Better Blues when you had Denzel and Wesley in the same film. Mm-hmm. You know, this is before Blade. This is before White Man Can't Jump and Passenger 57. But there was a space there when Denzel and Wesley were existing at the same time. It's funny because I was talking to one of my director friends, Demaine Davis, who was a producing director of Queen Sugar last season. And I was telling her I was coming on the show today and we're going to talk about that singularity, the Denzel effect.
Yeah.
And she said it's a little bit different now because of all the platforms that we have. Don't get it twisted. It's still not enough.
How do you all support one another in this process?
It's just trippy. We're all at the same award shows competing against each other. But it's like, it doesn't matter because one of us is going to win. And it doesn't matter because we're all here and we all got seats. Because we all remember, you know, doing that one episode of ER or the one episode of The Shield or whatever it was. Or, you know, NYPD Blue for all the New York actors, you know. So, you know, we just, it's amazing. Especially when we go to something like the BAFTA Awards.
Yeah.
Jahan, we at the BAFTA Awards.
Yeah, bro, major.
You know what
major.
I'm saying? At the BAFTA Awards tea luncheon or whatever. It's like, yo, man, my dude from Decatur, Georgia. You from Philly. You know, Chadwick from South Carolina. It was like, you know, Colvin Domingo's from Philly. You know, it's like, but we're all here together. And it's like, yo, I just remember the time when we were sleeping on each other's couches. You know, it's a great space to be in right now because, you know, of all the great writers and black writers and directors that we have who are creating these worlds that are allowing us to play where we don't have to have a white person writing about how to be black, you know?
Yeah, so. I can't remember a time where we had as many known quantities behind the camera. I mean, in the director's chair, Ava DuVernay, obviously, but Ryan Coogler, Antoine Fuqua, directed both, obviously, directed Denzel in Training Day, but also handled the two Equalizer movies that Denzel starred in. Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight and won an Oscar for the screenplay. And also Stephen Caple Jr.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, man. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
This is just a great time to be a black actor, just a black person in the film industry. You know, we got showrunners now. We got Donald Glover and we got Chao Coker. We got Lena Waithe. You know, we have these.
Jordan Peele also. I don't want to forget Jordan Peele.
I mean, there's a lot of us now. There's a lot of them now to create the narrative.
Arthur, you mentioned Denzel Washington as the benchmark. And you also mentioned the word megastar in your intro. And I think it's, you know, there's a difference between actor, even successful actor, and megastar.
Right.
I totally get that we're perhaps seeing a lot more success now than we've seen previously for black and non-white actors. But, but just taking Denzel as the first example in this question, there's no door that's closed to him. He's been in dramatic roles. He's been in action movies. He's been in thrillers. He's been in romances. He's been in comedies. He's even been in a horror film.
Right.
Does the industry give that same level of accessibility to other black actors in the way that it does to a huge amount of white actors? Like, for example, Kevin Hart and The Rock. Is the industry open to them doing the kind of roles that Denzel will choose to do? Particularly perhaps the more dramatic roles. I mean, I appreciate that may not be what they want to do, but is the industry open to it?
I mean, Kevin Hart and The Rock can do Shakespeare right now. They probably couldn't do it well, but they could do it. They can do whatever they want to do because they are the biggest star. Like, okay, Kevin Hart did a remake of The Untouchables, the one with Omar Sy, the French film.
That
he shot 3 years ago. They held on to it because it's a Weinstein film. Nobody wanted to put it out. They put it out 2 weeks ago with Bryan Cranston and made $20 million the first weekend. What? Like, he can do whatever he wants to do.
You're talking about The Upside. It's called The Upside here now?
Yeah, it's called The Upside out here, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm an actor's actor, so I don't know if I want to see everybody out there doing Shakespeare. If you can't handle comedy, I mean, you could try it. I think that there are certain people who can go out, like Jamie Foxx can do anything talent-wise that he wants to do. He's the most talented person I've ever been around in my life. It's, you know, as far as an artist, the man can sing, he can play piano like Thelonious Monk and Ray Charles, he can act, he can mimic, he can get anything greenlit. I don't know how much they'll put into it. But we talk about, you know, the white counterparts to him. I don't know if, like, all right, well, who's the white guy who can get anything done? With DiCaprio?
Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, Tom Cruise.
Matt Damon.
Yeah, there's a lot of them doing that.
That's the thing, right? When you run down the white side, we could fill up the whole 45 minutes of this show just running down names.
We could fill up a whole, you're right. Yeah.
And that's my point, because there are so many names at that level of actor who can just do whatever they want to do, like, and get the recognition for it, both in box office and award shows and critical acclaim, etc. It just, to me, implies that there's no barrier to them. Like, they can do whatever they want to do. There are no options off the table, no doors closed. And I want Isaac to chime in on this, because I know he's going to have some interesting stuff to say. But what do you guys think? Do you think it is now better than it was?
There's still barriers. I don't know if you remember when North Korea hacked Sony and they put out all those emails and they were like, we can't do the Denzel movie because it doesn't sell in China. Mm-hmm. And black artists said black people aren't international stars. So they still have that thinking. I went to Paris and I was just walking down the Champs-Élysées. And this is when Ray Donovan was out in Paris and everybody was going crazy. I was like, why is everybody? I was like, oh, you guys know me? They were like, you like cookie? I was like, yeah, I'm Cookie, yeah. Or even when I just came back from London, people were wigging out because they watch Queen Sugar. They bootleg it. And I'm like, I don't care how you get it, just get it. You know? I think the powers that be, they don't understand that black people have a wide reach. And if they just try to push it enough, then they could make, like how Chris Tucker was in Asia when he was doing all the films with Jackie Chan. I don't know if the studios understand the reach. Because off the top, we all are hip-hop. Hip-hop is already sold throughout the whole earth.
Sure,
and we still are the representation of that.
Right.
They have to work a little harder, or we got to work harder to, like, not be begging them for jobs and just do it ourselves.
And I think that's one of the primary points that, I mean, you guys have talked about this from the angle of the business side. And thankfully, since we have Omar here, we've gotten the look at it from the inside, you know, from an actor's perspective and the industry perspective. I think, though, we need to also look at this from the quote-unquote consumer's perspective, from the audience perspective. And from that perspective, I think, you know, why, you know, we have to ask the question, why is it important for the black community or people of color in general to see themselves represented on screen? You know, why is that important? And I think The Rock is a great example. I'm glad you guys brought him up. Because to me, I think that, and yeah, The Rock, I've seen, you know, I follow him on Instagram. I think he does, maybe not as strongly in public as he does in private, but he identifies as black, or at the very least as a person of color, mm-hmm. you know, as a big bald brown man is what he constantly calls himself. So I think he identifies as that. But like Omar said, he's an any man when it comes to film, when it comes to Hollywood. Most of his roles don't involve any type of racial aspect or cultural aspect at all. And I think that for the audience, we don't want, for the black audience or the people of color, moviegoers, we don't want an any man. We want a black man.
Right.
And I think the reason why is because it's more important. It's not enough to know that X amount of black actors are getting employed in Hollywood. That's important. But I think what we really want is to see our culture and our lives reflected on the screen.
Our stories.
Our stories. And The Rock is not going to do that. The Rock is very apolitical. He's actually very jingoistic when it comes to America and American military and things like that. Things that appeal to
Middle America
and the red states.
Right.
So he's very much on that side. So he's Will Smith in it, you know, to another level.
Yeah.
You know, Will Smith wasn't this far right. You know, he's The Rock is basically Michael Jordan, you know, doing what Michael did in the 80s and the 90s. And, you know, that's his thing. No shade. But I think that for us, what we're looking for is you know, something of ourselves reflect on the screen and not to have it singular. I think that back in the 80s, we had Spike, you know, we had Tillman, we had all the, we had a couple other directors, you know, who we could depend upon to bring these stories to screen, and a couple of actors. It felt like that was like our Hollywood. It wasn't necessarily, you know, mainstream in the way that the white movies were mainstream. And I think that what we're looking for now, and to me, I can almost see it happening, is that Hollywood, as it becomes desegregated, is going to mirror what happened in society when society became, or, you know, or pre-civil rights America, when it became, before it became desegregated. When you had segregation, and by no means am I supporting segregation.
But we spent about it in the community.
When you had segregation, you had communities like Bronzeville here in Chicago, which was known as the Black Metropolis. Mm-hmm. You know, so you had thriving businesses, right. Doctors, lawyers, you know, you had entertainment districts, you know, that were owned and patronized by Blacks. So once you desegregated, then all those things left. And, you know, then you, now you go through these neighborhoods and they look like ghost towns.
Right.
And so I see that happening in Hollywood. Are we going to get, you know, if we get more, if we can break this Denzel effect, as we're all, I think we're all kind of saying we're seeing it happen. As that happens, is our story is going to be reflected on screen, or is this going to be a any man thing?
You know,
where our actors are going to become more and more like The Rock.
You know, the thing about it is, I don't know how much of a plan this is, but Hollywood is really taking the really great Black independent filmmakers, Ryan Coogler, Ava, Barry Jenkins, Shaka King. And they're giving them these studio films. Maybe not for a lot of money. Creed was for a lot of money, but Selma wasn't. But Ava had only done Middle of Nowhere and I Will Follow. So those are two independent films. I think the first one was $20,000. The next one was $200,000. The next film she has is a $15 million budget. With Barry's first movie, Medicine for Melancholy, cost $12,000. If you see that movie changed my life. It was that amazing. So the very next movie he gets is Moonlight, $3 million, but it's a Paramount picture. So then at that point, you're in the system. You're in that studio system. Also, it's up to those directors to bring up the next one. Ava does that very well. Ryan Coogler is doing it with Shaka King now. He's bringing him up. I see what Jordan Peele is doing at Monkey Paw. One of my really good friends I did a film with, his name is Matthew Cherry. We did a movie on two iPods, and it's so good because it's about an Uber driver, but it's like iPhones. So we shot it on iPhones because that's how you use your Uber. It's, you know, but he, a brother named Matthew Cherry, pulled him up. So I appreciate those filmmakers pulling up the, you know, the ones that are right underneath them. It's like, it's your turn to keep the narrative going, because, all right, I just got finished doing the Central Park 5 miniseries with Ava. They're going to continue to give her big projects, but she is such a person of the people that she wants to tell these stories, and she's unapologetically Black, unapologetically, and will tell you to your face, anybody, and if you go, if you read her Twitter, she don't give a damn, you know, and I appreciate it. But it takes those filmmakers to bring the next ones up. And that's one of the things I didn't see back in the 90s. I don't know how many people, you talk about Spike, you talk about Singleton, you talk about whoever it was in the 90s who were the filmmakers. They weren't bringing those other ones up. I didn't see it. Maybe they were, but I didn't see it.
Well, I mean, for a while, 40 Acres and a Mule was the wheelhouse for a lot of Black talent.
Ernest Dickerson
started as Spike's cinematographer, and then
that's what I was going to say, was Ernest is the only director who I know. Ernest, and maybe I think he directed Drop Squad, but I think those were the two that he really brought up. No, he had his crew. You got to understand that whole Hampton crew. He had Vicky Thomas, who was doing casting. He had Robbie, who was doing casting. She's the president of casting at BET now. Ruth Carter, who I work with on Selma. Amazing, who did Black Panther. You know, she's probably the best costumer in the game. So he did bring them up. You know, but I mean, like, as far as filmmakers, as far as the people who are going to control the narrative, who's going to tell the stories.
Okay.
I don't know how many of those people he brought up like that.
Let me ask you this, though, Omar. You mentioned that I think the phrase you used with Michael B. is that there's a battery pack in his back. Like, they're boosting him up right now. You know, he's getting a lot of love. So Chadwick obviously got a lot of press over the last year and a half, but to me, that was more so, as much as that was about him, was also about Black Panther.
Yeah.
And the whole phenomenon of that movie. Why do you think, we all have our opinions, but why do you think Michael B. Jordan is the one that's kind of getting put up above everyone right now? I mean, outside of, you know, obviously there's talent there, but I'm just saying, why him and not Chadwick or Anthony or Sterling K, even though all of those actors are getting love, but not at his level?
I mean, because he's beautiful. You know, you know what I'm saying? That's, I mean, and he's young. You know, you got to think about that. Who we gonna put this for the next 15, 20 years? We had the whole ride with Denzel. But since Glory, we've had that ride with Denzel since about 88. This is 2019, 2018. Then they put out Equalizer 2 and made $150 million. Who are we going to put this? Whose back are we going to put this on? They've been looking for it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're like, okay, well, we can ride with him. Let's see what he'll do. I think, what is 32, 33 years old? How old is he? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, since I've known him since The Wire, you know, since he had the braids. And I asked him, I'm like, yo, man, what do you think it is about him? They're like, well, you know, shoot, yeah, he ripped. I'm like, okay, I get it, you know.
Right.
I get it. Right. And we got to just, you know, continue to see how he grows, you know, as an actor. You know, because I'm hard. I'm a critic, man. You dig? I'm a critic, man. And I'm, you know, they don't make to me like Denzel, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think, though, you guys have touched on, to me, the answer, if there's an answer to what, you know, this question that we're posing. And I think it lies with the creators. I mean, we're talking about artists, all actors, directors, writers, all of them are artists. But with the writers and the directors, that's kind of the genesis of these stories. You know, the actors, unless they're actor writers, are waiting for roles.
Right.
And so to me, you know, we call this the Denzel effect. To me, and you guys mentioned them earlier, but to me, the height of, you know, pride that I had as far as like a Black actor, and I'm speaking just on the male side, kind of ruling Hollywood, wasn't Denzel. It was Eddie. You know, it was when Eddie was ruling. That was, to me, that was the best reign because of his Blackness. You know what I'm saying? And what he brought to the screen in every role. Not, you know, besides the fact that, of, you know, the immensity of talent. But Eddie is also a writer. You know, people forget that Eddie's right. A writer. He's a comedian. He's a writer. He's written screenplays, co-written screenplays. He brings ideas to the table.
Right.
And to me, I think Ava and in particular Ryan Coogler is the future. You know, right. That I'm, you know, Creed, to me, I'm gonna be honest with you, I said this before in the show, Creed, the first Creed, is one of my favorite movies. It goes on my list of favorite movies of all time. I've watched that movie a dozen times now. And every time I'm just like, wow, this movie, as much love as it's gotten, it doesn't get enough love, in my opinion, for what Coogler did.
Yeah.
With that film, especially stepping in into a legacy, or, you know, a franchise that was already iconic.
Definitely,
you know,
yeah.
And doing what he did. To me, that as a writer, director, that's how we answer this question of, okay, how are we finally going to break this Denzel effect and elevate our, you know, actors and our stories to a level on par with the stories of white actors, right, and directors, and not be regulated to this kind of piecemeal, you know, storytelling. And again, I don't think it lies with the Any Man. I think it lies with the Ryan Cooglers and the Avas, who are going to say, okay,
yeah,
we're going to tell this story from a African-American or African point of view.
Right. I don't know if you ever heard Ryan speak. That dude is so unapologetically Oakland. And I love to hear him talk. He sound like he about that town business like Marshawn Lynch. And I'm like, man, I love hearing this dude sitting down talking to him or just hearing his interviews. It's funny, I saw this like roundtable of all the Marvel directors. Tiki is another dude. He it's the dude who directed Thor 3, the third Thor. Mm-hmm. He a wild dude too, but you know, he's he's from New Zealand. But Ryan was just, he sound like he about that town business, like some E-40 water or something. I was like, I love this unapologetically Black, man.
Yo, Omar, can you picture him pitching to Sly when he pitched Creed to Sly?
But I couldn't even, yeah, that would be the most. Yeah, because I haven't worked with Ryan, so I talked to my friends who was on Panther. They was like, yeah, he'd be like, yeah, yeah, man. And, you know, you got to go around there. Yeah, man. And then do that. Yeah, do that again. Yeah, do that again. It's like, yo, he a visionary, because it's like, if you can communicate like that, man, that's a beautiful thing, because that's the way I talk.
One thing about Creed that I just thought was such a stroke of genius was that, I mean, Carl Weathers was a major character in Abstentia.
Yeah.
Just yeah. as the ghost of Apollo Creed.
Right.
And I had the same kind of affinity that Isaac has for Eddie Murphy with Richard Pryor, who had that same kind of range that Kevin Hart is exhibiting now. I mean, he did more serious roles like Some Kind of Hero, Lady Sings the Blues, Bingo Long, right. Bingo Long and His All-Stars.
Yep.
He did straight up comedy like Stir Crazy, Which Way Is Up, Silver Streak.
Yeah.
And see, all these things you're talking about, Arthur, it makes me think, I wonder, and I know we have to get to the female side of this.
I'm coming to that too. Go ahead.
We need to get to that. But before we do, I think all of these things you're talking about, it makes me wonder, this fear, and I'm going to use the word fear. We haven't used the word fear yet, but I'm going to put it in there. This fear that Hollywood has of, you know, elevating these black actors, how much that has to do with the fear of black maleness? Because everything you just said, Arthur, is very rooted in the black male experience in America. And then when you talk about Creed, that's a story. Like you mentioned Apollo Creed being, you know, represented in Abstentia. That's essentially the story of a black man and his son.
Exactly.
You know, the son he didn't even meet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a father-son story. Mm-hmm. I mean, the last scene, almost the second to the last scene, when he's standing there in the ring and the guy asks him, you know, what would you tell your father right now? When he said, I ain't going to say it because I don't want to get teary-eyed up on here. When Michael B. says that line, it's like, if you have a father, if you lost your father, you feel what he said right there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a uniqueness to it, again, because it's a black male experience that's, you know, represented throughout that film. So I wonder, all that to say, I wonder how much of this kind of avoidance Hollywood has had with black male actors, how much it has to do with avoiding black maleness in general.
Like I said, the reason that I do love where we are now is because we're telling our own stories. They wouldn't even think about that. Killmonger had daddy issues too. So Ryan has gone twice with that because it's important, man, about the black father being absent or whatever it is or not being in the home. And
right,
white Hollywood would not even know how to approach that. So, like, it takes that writing from a black person's point of view, especially a black male's point of view, of a black man who has lost his father, however it was, through violence, whether he's getting killed in a ring or getting, you know, killed in his apartment, you know, on the third floor by his brother while he goes away in a spaceship. You know, it's, but it's that, you know, being that young and having that taken away from you, you know. Mm-hmm. So it takes us, there's a certain experience. Man, who was I talking to? I was talking to Ruben Santiago Hudson. And I was supposed to be, we might be doing this Broadway play together. He's going to direct it. And he said, man, we were reading this play. He's like, it's hard for a white director to direct a black theater show, a black play, because they don't understand what it feels to have that grease in your hands after you got finished plaiting your baby hair, or you know the way that crackling smell after you get finished frying that chicken. You know, these are vivid things to us,
mm-hmm.
and we understand it. Like we get it. The way Isaac was saying, like you know, about just the black community and how it is. It's like before segregation. I never want to be like, yo, man, things are better before segregation. The money stayed in the community way longer than it did after integration, you know what I'm saying? And I think because we always think the white man's ice is colder, that we have to feel that we have to go that way. But there's nobody who can tell the black stories the way that we can.
I mean, and that's why I say I think that what Ava and what Ryan has done is deserves special attention, because, you know, to take Black Panther and to get the job, first of all, but then to pitch to Marvel that story that he pitched,
right.
You know, that's you know, that's crazy. You know what I'm saying? Because it's like they weren't thinking that direction at all.
Right.
You know,
right.
They were probably thinking, hey, let's have an all black cast.
Right.
That's probably what they were thinking. But he took it and said, okay, how can I tell a story that's unique to us and something that deserves to be talked about and something that we talk about amongst ourselves, but not really in mixed company, so to speak.
Exactly.
So that's I think that's important. So, yeah, I'm interested in seeing how this plays out. But I'm not going to lie, I do have a little bit of trepidation, especially when I see, like I said, like you said, you know, the number one star right now is The Rock.
Right.
And he is black. But, you know, there's no real blackness reflected in his movie roles. Except sometimes when he's with Kevin Hart.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You get that byplay.
Yeah. So he can probably be able to do that. The thing about it is you can do whatever you want to do. You can do an independent film. Nobody's going to tell you not to do it. But sometimes you strike while the iron is hot. Look, if they're paying somebody $2 or $3 million or $4 or $5 million or whatever it is, then you want to call. You want to go and get that because you never got that before. Mm-hmm. Bozeman just got finished doing this movie, 13 Bridges, and it's not a huge budget film. But he's going back to Black Panther 2. You know what I'm saying? To go get that bag. And then she can go bounce back and forth. I didn't really see that from Fox. He did a few character pieces. Collateral was a character piece, you know. But most of the things he did were big budget films because he probably felt like, look, I have to lead the charge to be the next Black actor after Denzel. And Will Smith probably thought the same thing. You know, he did a couple of smaller ones, but you have it's your choice to do what you want to do. And don't get it twisted, Denzel directed Fences and produced it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, it might be a small film, but it's under his umbrella.
And
August Wilson is very near and dear to him. So, you know.
You know, I think when because we're talking about the big, you know, mega stars, and that's what this show is about. But to kind of paraphrase something that Chris Rock said a long time ago in a stand-up, we'll really know that we've gotten there or that we've accomplished something when Black and people of color actors who are mediocre, yeah, you know, who aren't that great, are still getting paid and still getting roles. Because we could, as many megastar white actors as we can name, yeah, we could also probably name or at least point out a slew of, you know, mediocre, middle of the road white actors who are in every other movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm, still getting paid. So that's, I think that, yeah, we can have our Denzels, we can have our Jordans, our, you know, we can have our, you know, singular superstars. But for us to really have a, you know, to really be comfortable in any kind of industry is when you don't have to be, you know, so singular or so at the peak of something in order to earn a paycheck.
Right. No, I agree with that.
Can a Black woman fill this space now in a consistent way? You know, we were talking about megastars, and in the 80s, the closest thing I believe that we had to a black female megastar was Whoopi Goldberg.
Yep.
And interestingly enough, Whoopi Goldberg, her first film was not a comedy, which is atypical.
Yeah.
It was The Color Purple.
Color Purple, yeah.
And then she went on to do, you know, Sister Act, Jumpin' Jack Flash, Burglar, Ghost, which was a co-star role, but the way she did it, she elevated as a, you know, as a A-list role in that way.
No, she won the Oscar.
Oh, did she win an Oscar for that?
Yeah, because it was a payback she should have won for Color Purple, but, you know.
It's interesting, Arthur, to answer your question. If I had to guess, I would say I feel like a Black female actor, a Black actress, may be a little bit less threatening to Hollywood than a Black male actor. To kind of go back to my earlier point about maybe Hollywood is afraid of Black maleness. But then I wonder, man, it's interesting because why is it that we, and I say we, not just Black, I'm just talking about public in general, are so very accepting and willing to champion Black female singers, musical artists, but we don't put that same love behind Black actresses. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
That's real, yeah.
There's no equivalent to Beyonce, you know, in the Hollywood realm. As far as I know, I can't think of anybody. Why not?
You know what? Okay, so when we were doing Selma, I had a long conversation with Tessa Thompson, right? And she's like, Omar, you got 30, 40, 50 years to do this. She said, I probably got about 10, 15. It blew my mind when she said this. I was like, but this is before Creed, before Thor Ragnarok. This is just Tessa, you know? And I was like, I said, yeah, but Tessa, you're so good, you're so pretty, and you're so talented. Like, I think Hollywood will snatch you up, which they have. Mm-hmm. But she put it in perspective. She was like, there's a shelf life for women, period, Black women specifically. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think about it until she said that. I was like, you know what? You're 100% right. Now, I think if there's anybody who's going to be that type of star, it's probably Tessa. Mm-hmm. She's the new lead of Men in Black, you know, which is a beautiful thing within itself. But I think that they look at women I don't. There's not a lot of women who have a, you know, a Meryl Streep will have a long career.
Right, Meryl Streep.
And I think a Viola will too, because they're prestige actors. You know, they're undeniable, and they're not selling sex appeal. They're not selling, oh, this is like, we're doing this movie, we need this specific person, the Jane Fonda or whatever. Jane Fonda flipped it because she was the sex spot, but she became the critic, you know, the critical darling like that. But even with Sally Fields, man, like, you know, she probably had a 20-year run, and probably just, and it stopped until she played Forrest Gump's mom. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it's just women in particular. I think that's just women. I think that's just how they do women. But like I said, man, black women, they always gonna put my sisters on that totem pole at the, you know, at the lowest end, man. And it's not fair. You know, it's just not fair. You know, I hope that changes. I hope it does. You know, it's good to see Cicely Tyson still out here rocking at 94 years old.
Definitely.
But hey, does this current climate of diversity and, you know, even wokeness be a positive thing for this kind of progress, you know, marching forward? I mean, you know, Taraji,
that's
even
the problem.
Janelle Monáe with, you know, doing Hidden Figures with Octavia Butler, you know, having
I just got finished doing this Harriet Tubman film, right? Cynthia Erivo.
Oh, right. Okay.
Johanna, I know you probably know. Y'all don't know who she is.
Say her name again.
Cynthia Erivo. She played. She's a Color Purple. She played the same character that Whitney played on Broadway. So she is an action star. Have y'all seen Widows? I don't know if y'all seen Widows.
Mm-hmm. I have not seen. That's on my list. Yeah, I've heard good things, though.
Well, she's like she's the one with the short hair. She's running all hard in the commercial. Uh-huh. She's an action star. She plays Harriet Tubman, and she's climbing rocks. Shooting guns, like it's a Western. So I mean, like, that's somebody you're gonna have to look out for real. She got next. She got next.
I think, Arthur, though, you said you used the word diversity, and I think that's part of the problem, though, in my opinion, is that because Black Hollywood has been denied for so long. If we go from where we were and then jump to diversity, I think that's a problem, because in my opinion, if you say diversity to Hollywood producer, they're thinking, okay, we got this movie, we got five characters. Let's make sure one of them is a person of color and make sure one of them is a woman. Mm-hmm. And they got the diversity box checked. Mm-hmm. Good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. We're good. Mm-hmm. That's not accomplishing nothing.
You're right.
Right.
So I think that I'm starting to hate that word diversity. I think that we need to go from where we were to Omar's earlier point and telling our stories and having the latitude and the freedom to do that. Diversity, you know, to me, that's just a term, that's a hashtag, that's really doesn't mean anything. So I feel like that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
So if I could, I'd like to talk about the elephant in the room.
What's that?
Something that we have yet to mention after going on this for almost an hour. There was a lot of attention cast on Idris Elba 2017-2018 in the wake of Daniel Craig sunsetting his participation in the role of James Bond.
Yeah.
And a fervor went up about Idris Elba being the one to be cast as the next Bond.
Right.
I mean, think about it, though. How crazy would it be that Stringer Bell becomes James Bond?
Yo,
an actor,
man,
going from that evolution.
That dude is so dope, man. I'm gonna tell you, man. Like, he another person who can do anything. He can do the comedy. He can do a period piece. He can do drama.
But he could do, I mean, he could, Idris could do Bond.
Yeah,
he's got the class, he's got the build, he's got the age.
Yeah.
He's got the range.
Yeah.
They don't want him.
I mean, Jahan, that's one you got to take, because I don't understand. Like, that's a Brit thing. It's like, man, this is a dude who's homegrown. And like, yo, we can really, this is something you can get behind, you can be proud of. Be like, yeah, first one, it's this guy right here. It's just, you know, Idris Elba.
I think Bond is too institutionalized in white Londoners.
Okay.
It's just funny to me how it works. Like, why get so protective over a fictional character when you haven't really been that protective of him in the past? Like, if you're going to do it, but don't suddenly draw the line when it comes to race.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're being honest, if you're actually going to go to the Ian Fleming novels, James Bond has a Scottish father and a Swiss mother, right? So Sean Connery is the only one who kind of qualifies there.
Yeah.
But everybody else, nah. Roger Moore, English. David Niven, English. George Lazenby, Australian. Timothy Dalton, Welsh. Pierce Brosnan, Irish. Daniel Craig, English. You know, it's funny how all that's okay, but a black dude is a step too far. And you know, real talk, if you're okay with having a car that can drive underwater,
right?
But no, a black dude right. is a step too far. I mean, come on. And to even claim like it's unrealistic that there are black people in our Secret Service is, I mean, I just don't know what they're thinking.
But so,
you know, I do think in this particular example, it's about the possessiveness of fanboys over fictional material. But it's interesting that it's interesting what triggers that possessiveness. Mm. Like, for example, John Boyega in The Force Awakens. You know, the first, like when the trailer dropped, John Boyega in a stormtrooper outfit is the first image right. you see. And there was right. uproar online from a lot of these fanboys saying a stormtrooper can't be black. And it just blows my mind that they are going nuts over a character. They've never seen that character's face.
Exactly.
I mean, newsflash, it's set in space, and apparently it's still racist there.
Right. right.
To be this kind of wild over, oh no, he cannot be black. It's crazy. So I do think they have this possessiveness and propriety over this stuff. But it's interesting what triggers that at its fiercest. And, you know, often there's no getting away from it. It's race.
Is it fair to say that this is a rational fear of what could be? I mean, for example, we've seen what irrational fear has done when we put a black man in the White House.
Right.
Well, right. my take on this, and I think I've mentioned this maybe before on a different show, is that I agree with everything you guys just said as far as why that fear or why that kind of pushback happened with Idris and Bond. But even then, I didn't want a black James Bond. And the reason is because I don't want to be, and this is, you know, this happens all the time where they take a quote unquote white story or a European, Anglo-European story and slate a person of color in it, and nothing about that story changes. If you put a black actor in James Bond, then James Bond changes. Black British is different than Anglo-European British. You know, it's just a different thing. Right. So I didn't want to see Idris become Bond and nothing about Bond's character changes. I wanted to see what is it like for a black Brit to serve in MI6? You know, what would that be like? It has to be different. There has to be different nuances. There has to be different obstacles. It's just a completely culturally different thing. So that's why I didn't want it. I wanted to see if anything, I would like to see them create a new character for Idris and have him do that. But I'm not in favor ever of seeing, you know, us take over traditionally white movies or roles and just, you know, flip them and say, okay, let's just throw a black character in there, such as Hamilton. I'm not a fan of that. You know, I know that that's, you know, that's become an iconic part of modern culture, but that's not something I'm in favor of. I think we have enough stories of our own that need to be told, that we need to concentrate on telling those and not having this almost this paternalistic opinion of their culture and say, well, you know what, let's just slot ourselves into their position and that'll elevate us to their level.
Okay.
I'm definitely not advocating for a lack of original stories, far from it, but I don't know why you can't have both. Like, are the two mutually exclusive? Specifically, what would be the problem with roles like Bond being open to people like Idris Elba? If he wasn't asked to whitewash his performance, if he wasn't asked to impersonate Daniel Craig, if he was allowed to be, you know, himself to the degree that he is in any role, what would be the issue there?
No, I don't think there's any. The key, what you just said though, Jay, you said if he were himself, that's the key to what you said. I'm with it. If he's going to be Idris Elba, who is a black Brit, I'm cool with that. But my fear is that they put him in the James Bond role and he's Daniel Craig, or he's, you know, Roger Moore. He just happens to be black.
I do get what you're saying. I guess I just don't think the two categories are mutually exclusive. Like, you should be able to do whatever you want without the industry stopping you from doing it. Definitely the goal would be to be able to tell exactly what we want to tell on our own terms and get financed for it the same way anybody else gets financed for it and backed and marketed, etc. But by the same token, another goal is to not be shut off from anything.
Agreed. You're talking about freedom, so I'm never going to argue against freedom.
What are your feelings about black Brits playing these characters. You know, I'm in Selma when I'm looking on the call sheet. Number 1, 2, 3, and 4, the four leads are all British. Mm-hmm. David Oyelowo, Carmody Jogo, Tim Roth, and forgot the dude to play LPJ. I forgot his name. He has an Oscar. I forgot his name, but he, you know, now, you know, just got finished doing Harriet Tubman and Cynthia as a Brit. You know, there's a lot of kick, there's a lot of pushback with David when he did Get Out. It wasn't a lot. It was Sam Jackson who was like, yo,
right. I don't. That is a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot because he is the, you know, he's the non-data. So he's talking, he's like, I don't get why you know, black American actors aren't getting these roles, you know? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? I remember Carmen told me one time, she was like, yo, I just go in there and they think I'm more intelligent because I talk with an accent.
Mm-hmm. that's probably true.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely a snobbery about training, but there's an automatic presumption about who has trained. I'm assuming that most American casting directors look at somebody from the United Kingdom, listens to their accent,
right,
and just assumes that they've had this great theatrical training. And they may automatically assume that that training is Bristol Old Vic or Royal Shakespeare Company or
RADA, BADA.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. RADA, LAMDA, all of that. And that snobbery is rooted in a lot of things. It's not just acting, but yeah, definitely I'm sure that automatic presumption exists, and it discounts anyone else who may have trained locally to wherever they are. It completely discounts that. And it's a misconception because not every British actor has trained in those places or is good. But yeah, it looks like it's something that they benefit from when they go transatlantic.
I find that interesting. I mean, isn't it fair? I mean, isn't the gold standard of black acting Sidney Poitier? I mean, isn't he like the goat of this whole thing?
No.
For us?
No.
Okay, Omar, you say no.
No, he ain't the goat. He's the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, he's Dr. J. Denzel is Michael Jordan. You know what I'm saying? It's that's what it is. It's not. He's not the goat. I don't think. I mean, he has played some really amazing characters. To Sir with Love, and Here Tonight. What's the one he did with Tony Curtis? The Defiant Ones. Those are really great roles, but he's not the best, I don't think.
I think maybe more importantly is what the industry thinks, and the industry will have its view on who the greatest is. But who is the one making that assumption? Who is the one declaring that Carmen Ejogo's training is superior to Angela Bassett or Viola Davis? Because it's their prejudices that you've got to look at. Who's the one who's saying this person is the greatest? Often, I imagine it's producers, casting directors, and directors, because they're the ones with the power to greenlight someone in a role or not, and it's their prejudices that you've got to look at.
I agree. Yeah, I agree 100%. I agree 100%. I think that, Jay, to your point, though, I think it's that, and it's about, I mean, Arthur, Omar, made this happen to you guys, where you've had a person tell you in the job situation, or anywhere, really, you know, you speak so well.
You're crazy. Yeah, that's,
to be fair, that happened.
Okay. That's happened to me.
Okay, but you know, I'm saying Idris was Stringer Bell.
But hold on, Arthur. Has that ever happened to you? That's happened to you, Arthur, before, I'm sure.
Yeah, most people think I'm white when I'm on the phone. But go ahead.
And so to me, to John's point, is their perception. And it's that old, you know, who's the most educated? Who's the most intellectual? And I think that if we were going to be honest, mainstream America, the ones making these decisions that you're talking about, Jahan, from a consumer point of view, and then obviously from a power structure point of view, you're not talking about black Americans or people of color in those positions. Those people regard African Americans in a completely different light than they regard British Africans, mm-hmm. African Brits, mm-hmm. or even Africans. There's an exotic higher level that they put them on. We at the bottom of that totem pole, you know, so they don't regard us with that same sort of sophistication as they view black Brits. And so and to be honest, it's not fair for what's my man's name from Get Out?
Daniel Kaluuya.
David.
Daniel Kaluuya.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not fair for him to get hate. You know what I'm saying? I don't think that's fair. But here's, I think, just to be, as John would say, to be fair and to be to have some understanding about this. where does that come from? I think it comes from because Black American actors have been overlooked for so long. Mm-hmm. Now that all these roles are coming out, you're going to skip us and go to who you feel is our kind of more sophisticated cousins.
You know, even you understand what Sam Jackson has been doing for years. He was the one who fights for Black actors, Black American actors. He was the one who was saying, why are you hiring all these rappers when these people are coming out of Howard University, they're coming out of Morehouse, they're coming mm-hmm. out of Yale, they're coming out of NYU. Why are you hiring mm-hmm. T.I.? I love Tip, that's my dude. But why are you hiring Ludacris to play this part that Dorian Missick should be playing? You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? So he's always been on the forefront of doing that. And he's always had, you know, our backs. So he was the one talking about Daniel. I thought, man, Daniel's a monster. I love that dude. He a beast with it. You know, mm-hmm. So I ain't got nothing to say bad about that. I got nothing to say bad about any of the people I work with, you dig? But it's just like, they come, you know, like people come over here and they just get that first opportunity as soon as they land. They might, I mean, and it starts with, they might get the best agent. They might get with CAA mm-hmm. early before they even need to be with CAA or William Morris or ICM. But they're going to be there because we got the hot new Brit. You know, we got, what's my man's name? John Boyega. It's like, yeah, man, mm-hmm. but Lakeith Stanfield over there. You know
right.
what I'm saying?
Right.
But basically, the establishment in anything is always what's presumed to be the benchmark. So, you know, in this example, English theatre, not even English TV or English film, but English theatre is regarded by the gatekeepers and those who have control over the system and those who have the power to award a role or not. It's regarded by them as the benchmark.
Shakespeare is the benchmark.
Right, that's what you're talking about, right, Joe?
Yeah, that and also where you've graduated from, what plays you've done, etc. Absolutely all of that.
And they think that everybody who's British can do Shakespeare. You know, so it's just like, okay, where that there you are. I was lucky enough when I was in London a couple months ago to go see my friend Andre Holland, monster actor, from Alabama, play Othello at the Globe. And used his southern accent. He's a southern gentleman. So he used this, you know, he's Othello's a fish out of water anyway. He's a black southern man and a white, you know, and playing it that way. It can be done. And I told myself, I was like, I would like to do 6 months in London after I get done with Queen Sugar this season. I wonder if it would work in reverse, where the American comes to London and can get a lot of work. I was wondering about that.
I think it actually kind of does, because plays over here always seem to be much more in demand when there's an American star acting in them. And American actors get a lot of opportunities here in the theatre. Like, for example, it was almost an entirely American cast I saw with Count on a Hot Tin Roof, Sana Lathan, Felicia Rashad, James Earl Jones.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Denzel do Shakespeare very early in his career?
They all did. I mean, he did Midsummer's Night Dream. He did the movie Midsummer's Night Dream.
Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, you come up doing Shakespeare. We all did. You have to.
As much as I understand why that is, I think that kind of what Jahan's saying, that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Is the fact that Shakespeare is the benchmark.
Yeah.
And
Shakespeare is a bad dude, boy. That boy, he could write his ass off, man. Yeah, I'll never take nothing away from him. So is August Wilson. So is Katori Hall. So is Coleman Domingo and Robert O'Hare. You know, it's a bunch of it. So is Ozzie Davis. Amazing playwrights. All of them.
All right. Well, with that, I'd like to move into a new segment, a game. We call this Black Roulette, wherein we take a person of color, actor or actress, and the role that they played in one film or TV show, and then insert them in character into a distinctly white film or TV show. I mean, so for example, if you chose Martin Lawrence as Martin from the 90s TV show Martin, and say, hey, we're going to have Martin as Martin in Seinfeld, and he'll replace Jerry Seinfeld
yes.
as the same guy. So instead of Jerry Seinfeld, it's Martin. And then a scenario where worlds collide.
Kramer, George, Elaine,
right.
and Martin.
So Martin carries his blackness into Seinfeld.
Exactly. No change, nothing. Just as is.
Let me. You know what? Listen, I'm a Seinfeld head. Jay is too, unashamedly. But in all, what, 8 seasons, I think I can count on one hand how many black people I saw on that show. And not just speaking roles. I'm talking about in the background. You know what I'm saying? Like extras. You know, it's like there were no, evidently in that part of Manhattan, there are no people of color.
Right. Like even the brother that Elaine dates turns out to be a white guy.
You mean Arthur? You mean Arthur?
Wow.
I'm sorry, Arthur. Go ahead.
That's all right. To run this down. So we were, each of us were assigned two actors. I want one of you, either Isaac or Jahan. I want one of you to start this off.
I'll go first. But I think it's also important, as I understand, it's also important that to say that we're not just placing these people of color into white movies. We're placing them into movies and or roles that people of color are typically excluded from. So yeah, white Seinfeld was something that clearly black actors were excluded from. So I think that's a great example, but I'll go first. All right. Well, my first name that I was given was, to coincide, I guess, with today's show, was Michael B. Jordan as Killmonger. That's my actor, and that's my role. So I came up with this while you guys were talking, because you know I don't listen to you guys while you talk on the show. Michael B. Jordan as Killmonger in Game of Thrones.
Oh, that'd be dope.
So, little background here, in case you don't listen, you're new to the show and maybe you haven't heard some of the past episodes, but I do have a bone to pick with Game of Thrones. Not only because it's one of the whitest shows on television, but also because it exists, like Star Wars, it exists in a realm that does not exist. So this is completely fictional. So the creators of this show and George R. R. Martin, who wrote the books, decided that in their fictional realm, there aren't any black people. I've seen scatterings of people of color. John, you watch the show more than I do, but essentially this is a white show.
And the black king, they locked in a safe.
That's right.
Right, I remember right. that one. You're right, yeah. Right. Right, so I picture Killmonger in this show, at a meeting with, they're talking about the Seven Thrones or whatever the hell they talk about on that show. Taking over and... You know, the winter is coming and there's giant white monsters that are coming, blah, 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 blah. And I can see Killmonger, if you haven't seen Black Panther, maybe this, you won't get this, but if you have seen Black Panther, you will understand this. I can see Killmonger basically just stopping this meeting in the middle of this meeting, looking around and asking, why are there no black people in this realm? None of these realms. And then he just starts killing people.
Yeah.
Did I get too dark on you? Is that too dark?
Is this your king? Or queen, actually, might be more appropriate given who she's leading.
So that's mine.
Who's next?
I can go next if you want me to.
Go.
All right, Chris Rock's Pookie from New Jack City. I got him in Three's Company as Mr. Furley. Played by the great Don Knotts.
Winner. Next.
I can just see him just going through everybody's apartment looking for something, trying to figure it out.
Just wait till everybody leaves and then going through their apartment.
Exactly. I can just, you know what, Mr. Furley, I always thought that Jack Tripper he thought he was gay. Just see a Pookie just going all out with the insults. Like straight 1970s style, 1980s insults that you can never say today in today's world.
Dude, until you said that, I mean, was there ever a black person on Three's Company?
I don't ever remember.
A Latino, anybody.
They were living in Malibu, so they're living in Malibu or Venice. I forgot where they were living at. So I don't think it was any. Nah.
Next. Good luck following that.
I'll go. The actor I was given was Winston Duke as M'Baku, head of the Jabari tribe from Black Panther. And I'm going to sub M'Baku for F. Murray Abraham's portrayal of Antonio Salieri in Amadeus.
Amadeus, oh my God.
So,
and you know Winston would kill it. Winston would kill that shit.
So M'Baku is a well-placed composer who's challenged by this young upstart, Mozart, played by Tom Hulce. And, you know, he sees that, you know, this upstart, you know, he's gifted, he's talented, you know, but M'Baku believes that it was the goddess Bast who is behind, you know, M'Baku's rise and status of privilege. And but he can't understand why Bast seems to be forsaking him. You know, Mozart's taken his the woman that he has the love interest with. He's taken all the attention of the emperor whose court that M'Baku is serving in, you know. And M'Baku, you know, he's writing these operas. He's got the Jabari tribe singers backing him up, you know, and, you know, M'Baku's conducting, yeah, kai kai, and they're singing, whoa, and they're doing all that. You know, he's got him rocking, you know, but Mozart is still taking all the shine, you know. And so at a certain point, the climax of it is M'Baku just had it, and he swears to the goddess Bast that he will destroy her creation by feeding him to his children.
That's good.
Now, is he joking about the feeding into the showing part?
He's serious this time. He did serious.
He's serious.
That's a good one. I like that.
Wow.
All right, Jay, it's on you.
Okay, so I don't know how I can follow that, but I'll try. So the actor I've been given is John Leguizamo as Benny Blanco from the Bronx in Carlito's Way. So I'm about to drop bare spoilers on you, so apologies. So the climax of Carlito's Way shows the hero, Al Pacino, about to get away from the life, from the criminal life, with his woman, with the woman he loves, and escape it all, leave it all behind. And he's just about to leave, just about to get on a train out of New York City, Benny Blanco from the Bronx shows up to take revenge on him for a relatively minor insult earlier on in the film. And the way he shows up is, he's just like, hey, Carlito. Pulls out a gun, but, nah, you stay here. So the movie I'm going to put him in is Stanley Kubrick's classic from 1960, Spartacus.
Oh my God.
And the scene that I think he will shine in is towards the end, pivotal scene, probably the most famous scene actually. Spartacus' slave rebellion has been defeated and Crassus, the Roman general, shows up and is like, yo, I will spare all of you slaves. I'll spare all your lives. Just give me the man who started this. Give me Spartacus. And a slave named Antoninus, played by Tony Curtis, he's like, nah, I can't let you take Spartacus. So he stands up and he says, I am Spartacus. And slowly, one by one, loads of other slaves stand up and say, I am Spartacus, I am Spartacus. So the Roman general doesn't know who to take. And Spartacus is spared until they decide in quite a downbeat fashion to crucify all of them. So I'm thinking we can remix it, and instead of Tony Curtis standing up and saying, I am Spartacus, we could maybe have Benny Blanco from the Bronx arriving as unceremoniously as he did in Carlito's Way, standing up and saying, nah, you stay here, pup, taking out the Roman general, and somehow, nonsensically,
oh my God,
turning the tide and letting the slaves win.
This is why Hollywood wouldn't let any more black actors in.
Right,
this,
exactly.
This shit right here.
This has been Snobs on Film. We want to thank Omar Dorsey for joining us in the guest snob chair. Program note, we did record the show before this year's Oscars, where Driving Miss Daisy won its unprecedented second Best Picture Award. But we do invite you to join us on the conversation online. We can be found at snobsonfilm.com. Our Twitter handle is snobsonfilm, and our Instagram is snobsonfilm. The show library is found everywhere fine podcasts are distributed. We invite you to give us a review and rate us in iTunes. Please, the last star on the right always does the trick. We're also available on Spotify, Stitcher, Castro, Overcast, Pocket Casts, everywhere you can find fine podcasts. See you next show. We'll be right back.
the informal vote, I'm gonna vote first, and I think that Arthur's winning. I thought Omar was gonna win until Arthur went.
Yeah,
that shit is hilarious.
Yeah, Omar or Arthur. Definitely.
I'll placate to the guests and say Omar took it.
Nah, Arthur, you know you won that one, man. Come on now.
Everybody under the age of 30 is already turned off.
Yeah,
right now,
so.
I know, right?
Uh-huh.